Accession number 30018, reel 3.
John Valley, reel 3. So what was the next stage, obviously, after you'd done your training with the vampire?
Well, we got our wings in the summer of 56. Sorry, 57. However, around April time, some 6 or 8 weeks before we were due to get our wings, a chap called Duncan Sandys came out with his defence white paper where he said no more man fighters for the Royal Air Force and stuff like that. This had a big effect on the staff at Swinderby, because it was, you know, what were they going to do next sort of thing when they left their instructor's job. The students, we just rubbished it. We thought, well, this man doesn't know what he's talking about, you know. Of course there'll be man fighters, and of course the RAF will have them. Of course we shall fly them, you know. And we were more concerned about passing the course than we were about Mr. Sandys at that time. But once we got our wings, that was when we realised things had changed, because we would normally have been sent straight off within a week or so to the operational conversion unit, either to convert to hunters as we wanted or Canberras, and we weren't. We were sent home on indefinite leave, which you know, was very bad news. Then I think about 6 weeks later, I got a telegram, because telephones weren't really in widespread use in those days, and where you got messages to people was with telegrams. Telegram telling me to go to the station and get on a train and go to Valley. And my course had been sent to Valley, RAF Valley, Anglesey, which was another vampire training school. In particular, it was the one used by the Royal Navy at that time for training their fixed-wing pilots. And they had, they, Valley, had spare aeroplanes, because the student intake had now suddenly stopped because of Sandy's thing and so on. They had a lot of spare aeroplanes there, and so they could let us, these newly bewinged wonders, stay current, you see, in the same sort of aeroplanes as we'd been used to. So we all flew around at Valley, and I don't know how none of us got killed there, because we were flying Mutual, as it was called, in two-seat vampires, you know, two former students together. I mean, a couple of hundred hours total flying time or something. How high, how fast, how low, you know. I mean, you can imagine the sort of sillinesses that went on. And I can't believe that we didn't have accidents. So we must have been remarkably well trained, no question about it. But eventually we got sent to, or four of us got sent to Chivenor.
Could I ask with that, just how the vampire handled you as an aircraft?
Well, the vampire was a truly subsonic aeroplane. And by that I don't mean it wouldn't go as fast as the speed of sound. I mean, it would not get anywhere close to the speed of sound before it went out of control due to compressibility effects. And basically, none of us had ever seen 0.9 in a vampire. We had all seen between 0.83 and 0.87. And if you just went as high as one would go and pointed it straight down at the ground, as we had done with our instructors at Swinderby, you know, you got to the point where the aircraft would start to buck violently in pitch, uncontrollably, and would also drop a wing and rotate. And so you're plummeting downwards, and the controls would have no effect on this manoeuvre that the aeroplane was doing. And all you could do was to close the throttle and wait until you got to a lower altitude where the higher drag would slow the aeroplane down and reduce the Mach number, and then you just carried on flying. So it was a sort of ride it cowboy, a bucking, pitching, rolling thing. Meteor was similar. I think the vampire was probably a little worse than the Meteor in terms of this sort of behaviour. Not frightening, just a matter of fact, that's how it was. Well, one of the things, for example, that a couple of us at Valley had thought about was we reckoned that the shockwaves were forming around the Vampire because the wing was producing some lift, you know, it accelerates the air, and so you get shockwaves forming before the aeroplane itself has got to the speed of sound, because there are parts of the airflow that are going faster. And we said that the wing and its lift was the fundamental way the air got accelerated, and if we could only dive without any lift, then we wouldn't accelerate the air, the shockwaves wouldn't form, the aircraft wouldn't go out of control, and we could get to a higher speed. And the thing was, we didn't have an angle of attack gauge in airplanes in those days, which is something that tells you, in effect, how much lift the wing is being asked to produce. There is an angle of attack, that's the angle between the way the wing is facing and the way it's travelling, that angle. That angle of attack, if you get that to the point where it is either naught, or if the wing is not quite symmetrical, it would be a fraction minus one or something, there is zero lift on the wing. And now, without an angle of attack gauge, how do you get it, you know? And so we decided that just pointing it straight down, which was the routine sort of thing, wasn't going to work, because there are upper winds, you know, which produce a bit of angle. And so our idea was that we would wait for a high pressure and no upper air winds, and we would then point the airplane straight down. And the guy and I that we worked this out on, we had such a day, and off we went. And I've never seen anything like it. The airplane just went cleanly round to 0.9. I mean, here's this Vampire hurtling vertically downwards. I mean, it's a long way up. Not a buffet, not a twitch, as smooth as you like. And we looked across the cockpit at each other in amazement. But then, of course, we had to pull out of the dive, you know. And as soon as we touched the controls and put any sort of angle of attack on the wing, of course, it went berserk. And we were well down at sort of 10,000 or 12,000 feet before we got the thing slowed down, and because we hadn't thought it through. We hadn't thought, well, okay, so it works, and so you get up high speed. Now, how are you going to get out of that, you know? Anyhow, so those were the sort of things that went on in those days.
What sort of height had you begun the manoeuvre?
Oh, about 40. Again, as I say, not dangerous, because the thick air slows the aeroplane down. In fact, later on, 1982, I was asked to look at the high-speed characteristics of the new wing that McDonnell Douglas had produced for the Harrier, the one that is currently in service with the Royal Air Force. And they asked me to take it to high Mach number, and this was a wing that was not designed to go to high Mach number. It was designed for payload radius of action, so a high cruise efficiency, not high speed. And in fact, it's off a McDonnell Douglas DC-9 airliner, the Aerofol. And I got this thing going straight down and got a nice number of high Mach number on it. And then one was left with the same situation, and this thing was bucking and rolling through the sky, and it reminded me very much of the Vampire, and I said so at the debriefing. We actually shed a bit off the aeroplane because it wasn't... this was a thing called the dam. It was a cross door that came down below the fuselage between a couple of strakes, underneath the fuselage, to increase vertical takeoff capability, and this dam would normally be retracted flat under the fuselage, but it got sucked out slightly, and anyhow, it departed the aeroplane, and we never did find it. Anyhow, that was what was it like to fly? Vampire was a truly subsonic aeroplane, and yes, if you got it up to a high Mach number, you had compressibility effects, you know. So what sort of thing?
And at that time, were you more or less left to yourselves, really, just to carry on what you were doing?
Yes, we were always briefed and authorised by an instructor. Go and do some high-level aeros, or go and do an AVEX, or go and do whatever, you know, and then we were just left to get on with it.
And essentially that was, you know, you could do what you wanted there, could you,
Sure.
What was the next stage? Because obviously they were allowing you to keep your hand in there a little bit.
Well, eventually, four of us got posted to Chivna, and off we went to do the Hunter OCU. And in those days, I mean, I'm talking 1957, there were no two-seaters, and so you just had to get into a Hunter and fly it, according to the brief. And you had four, I think it was four, let's work out how much. Three or four, yeah. You had four Vampire T-11 sorties first. Three of them were dual. There was a dual sector recce, where you flew around the local area and the landmarks were pointed out to you, because in those days, aeroplanes didn't have nav systems. There was a dual instrument flying check, where the Chivna instructor checked you out for your instrument flying capability. There was the dual formation flying check. And then you had a solo sector recce. And that was that. And then you were sent off in the single-seater, which was all very exciting. And because the Hunter was a big beast compared to the Vampire. I mean, it was a long way up off the ground. The Vampire was very low and a very soggy, wallowy sort of undercarriage. With a very soft ride. And you wallowed your way along the ground in the Vampire. It had pneumatic brakes, and so when you put those on, there was a sort of hissing noise and not much deceleration and things. With the Hunter, you're up high. The undercarriage legs seem solid and rigid, and if you touch the brakes, there was this dong, you know, as the airplane stopped, and it just seemed a big monster. We flew this thing, and we passed out. Again, hard school, and there were a lot of people chopped and some people killed, as there were in those days, nothing unusual about it. And then we got our posting notices, and that was when it really went wrong, because Duncan Sandys' act had its effect. And of the six students that passed out on my OCU course, two of them were Cranwell cadets and so on, permanent commissions, and the other four of us were what they call direct entry, and so we were not career officers, if you see what I mean. And the Royal Air Force had decided that there were so few remaining fighter slots for pilots that they would be given only to the career officers. And so the four of us were posted to a ground job. Well, you can't imagine how awful that felt to fight your way through the whole training system, and then to be put on the ground by some politician. I mean, we'd marched, we'd flown, we'd done all sorts of things. Everything that the RAF wanted from us, we had managed to do it, and it was a lot, and now suddenly we weren't going to get what was our due. And I mean, unbelievably dispiriting. And the four of us were sent on a ground tour to the Royal Radar Establishment, which was a research establishment like Farnborough, but at Malvern, and it dealt just with radar. And they had an experimental GCI station, a ground control interception station. Fighter Command in those days had a whole bunch of radar stations around the country, and there was what was called a hole, because it was underground, in which the fighter controllers sat and looked at their radar screens and controlled the interceptions. Well, there was an experimental GCI hole called Z Block at Malvern, you know, where they developed the techniques and equipment for these fighter stations, fighter controller stations. And they had a team there who were investigating how to intercept supersonic aeroplanes, because the Russians had some supersonic dash aeroplanes attacking the United Kingdom with subsonic fighters called Hunters. And of course, it's not easy if in the traditional way that, because there were no guided missiles or things in those days, in the traditional way where the fighter chases the bomber and shoots it down, you know. The bomber's going faster than the fighter, it ain't going to chase it very far. So they came up with an idea that said, well, what we have to do is we have to fly the fighter towards the bomber, the incoming bomber, but the fighter needs to be offset and at a particular distance, which is obviously very critical, the fighter will start to turn. And the idea was that it got to the point about where the bomber flew past it in front about 600 yards and you could get a quick skirt at it, you see. Well, the chances of setting up that sort of interception were negligible, and they produced what they called overlays, which are a whole lot of cellophane sheets which controllers could lay on their tube, which had bomber tracks and fighter tracks and according to the speed and height and so on, and they had to try and talk their fighter around the right sort of track, you know. Well, most of the time, not all the time, the bomber was a synthetic blip that was driven across the screen at Z block by some AC2, you know, like a modern video game. Occasionally, they used Peter Twiss in the Fairey Delta 2, which was a supersonic airplane. But most of the time, it was synthetic blips. The fighters were always synthetic blips and were flown by another fighter pilot in another room, you know, off the side of Z block. When the bomber track came in, the fighter controller had to decide which of the fighter stations from the United Kingdom was best placed, you know, scramble a fighter. The fighter pilot would take off from this particular base and after an appropriate interval, you know, would be come up on the RT and so on. And if the interception failed, then the boffins wanted to know whether it was because the fighter pilot hadn't flown the track properly, or the bomber pilot hadn't done as he was told, or the fighter controller had used the wrong relay, or the fighter controller just overlay, or the fighter controller had just messed up. Well, it was the easiest thing in the world to just watch this going on and see why it had failed. You didn't need intelligent, experienced young aviators to do that. Any corporal, that's not a derogative term, but you know what I mean, anybody could have stood there, but they hadn't got those sort of people to spare, but they had these spare flying officers, and so we were given this job. I could not believe how awful, of course, it was not to be able to fly, but it was a round the clock job. We were on shift working and so on, and this meant that we had a lot of time off on occasions where you would not normally have time off during the day, during the week. So you could go charging about, digging out old girlfriends or whatever took your fancy. But nothing made up for the fact we were living in a hotel on rate one allowances and so on. Nothing made up for the fact that we weren't flying. And then one day, Matt McLaughlin, who was one of the four of us who, on that last batch from Chivna, he had to go down to Barnstable Magistrates Court because there was a little motoring offence, and so he went and dealt when he'd been on the course at Chivna. So he went and dealt with that. And after he came out, he went along to Chivna, to the crew room, to see our old instructors, and there were 84 hunters out there and no students. And they said, well, get yourself posted back here and you can have as much flying as you like, see? So he came back to our hotel, the Horny Old Arms, as it was called, and we sat around, as one does in the bar, at night, discussing this fact, you know, and long into the night. And I can't remember who it was that first came up with the idea that we ought to go to Bentley Priory. Now, Bentley Priory was the headquarters of Fighter Command at that time, so all administrators, and we were members of Fighter Command, having done the Hunter OCU. We were just on a ground tour. So anyhow, we decided to go there, and the following Wednesday, sports day, Mac and I went off in his Austin Healey 2000 and to Bentley Priory, and I don't think we had got the slightest idea what we were going to do when we got there. We didn't have a plan, but we found an office that had got two flight attendants in it, facing each other across desks, and one was in charge of day fighter postings and the other was in charge of night fighter postings. The day fighter guy had to poke off to go play sports at some other station, and that left us with a night fighter guy who was a javelin man, and he was bemoaning the fact that he should be flying his beloved night fighters and not sitting on the buddy desk posting people, you know, look, oh, I do this, I do that, you see, and that's all I do. So anyhow, he then had to go and play sports, and so we followed him out to the car park and bade farewell to our new friend, and as soon as his car disappeared around the corner, we shot back into the office and posted the four of us on the day fighter postings paperwork to Chivenor, you see, and went back to the Horny Old Arms. And that was a Wednesday, I think it was the following Tuesday. The squadron commander, who was a radar engineer in the Royal Air Force, he came in and in the morning, he said, I should never understand this man's Air Force. He said, we've just got you here. He said, you four guys are posted. Oh, no, sir, no, we love it here, sir, you know, all that sort of thing. I mean, the people at RADA couldn't have done a better bloody job. We were posted, and off we went the following week to Chivenor, and we started flying. And I don't know how long we'd been there, a week or 10 days. And the wing commander flying came in a MET briefing in the morning. He read out our four names from a piece of paper. He said, staging commander's office, 9 o'clock, and don't take your hats off. So we went to the station commander's office thinking, oh dear. And we were marched in by the station adjutant, and it was a full theatrical thing, you know, left, right, left, right, left, right, hop, you know. And we were standing there to attention in this bloke's office, and he was a group captain, and he hadn't got his jacket on, and it was over the back of his chair, and he apparently didn't know we were in the room, and he was shuffling papers and things. And then after a little while, he sort of picked up this bit of paper, looked up, saw us standing there, shuffled us a bit more, read out our four names. There was complete silence. He said, well, is that you? And we each just managed a yes, sir, going 6 foot half a grand dustbin lid, you know. And he said, I've got reason to believe that you've interfered with Her Majesty's posting process. Complete silence. Well, is that true? Yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. Have you got anything to say? No, sir, no, sir, no, sir, no, sir. It was complete silence. I don't know. 10 seconds, 15 seconds. It seemed like about 2 months. And he said, well, I have. He said, it's the best thing I've heard of since the Second World War. Would you like to go to fighter squadrons? And that guy posted the four of us to hunter squadrons in Germany. And it was because he was a World War II, Group Captain Pleasance, a World War II commander, who knew that what mattered in a fighting service was the morale of the bloody troops, and nothing else really matters. I mean that's an exaggeration, but without morale, it doesn't matter how good your training is, everything comes to naught, doesn't it? And he realised we were motivated. He realised we wanted to do it. So off we went, and there were four of us: Matt McLaughlin, Cooper. And Harvey, Morris Harvey, and Ron Cooper. Off we went. Well, Morris Harvey became an air commodore, and he was in charge of the whole of the Royal Air Force air traffic system. Mac McLaughlin became an instructor captain on British Airways on 747s. Cooper went back to Holyhead and fiddled with his MGs in his garage, and I got a sort of day job working for Hawkers. So it, those four guys, we all owe that bloke, you know, basically.
Mm. Which squadron were you posted to?
I went to 4th Squadron. I was the first pilot posted to 4th Squadron in 18 months because of the hiatus that there'd been, and because they were shrinking, 2TAF as it was called then, 2nd Tactical Air Force, and later it became RAF Germany. They had been shrinking the squadrons even before Duncan Sandys Act, and so pilots, in order to get their complete tour and get their duty free car, which they'd bought, you know, that sort of thing, were being extended, and so no new guys were posted in. So I was the first new pilot on 4th Squadron for 18 months, and the then junior pilot, until the day I arrived, he couldn't wait for the next guy to come, of course, because he was getting all the dog's body jobs. Anyhow, at the end of my four squadron tour,
can I just ask you a little bit about four squadron? Yeah. I mean, what size was it? You said it was shrinking, but what size was the size of the squadron?
Well, we had 18 pilots on the squadron. I think we had 12 or 14 aeroplanes. They were Hunter 4s as I joined, and Hunter 6s were just, they were just being replaced by Hunter 6s. Only one of the pilots was married, and that wasn't the squadron commander, it was one of the flight commanders. That was in 1958, different Air Force in those days. When I left, 2.5 years later, there were only two chaps that weren't married. In those days, you couldn't get married, you couldn't even ask permission to get married until you were 25 in the RAF. And if you did get married and got permission to get married, you then had to ask permission to live out, as it was called, and not in the mess. So, you know, very different Air Force in those days.
What was your proposed role in Germany with the squadron?
Intercepted A fighter. We used to stand what was called battle flight in those days, which is a couple of aircraft on continuous armed alert, where you were they're on the pan at the end of the runway, and you had to be able to be scrambled in 2 minutes to deal with the normal sort of air defence requirements that were going on in the Cold War. Usually, when you got a scramble, it was to recover one of your own, especially the German Sabres, where the chap had got lost and was wandering off towards the east and had to be grabbed and brought back or something, you know. Occasionally, Russian aeroplanes would apparently have exercises where they come charging towards the west, you know, and we'd get scrambled and everybody would turn around and go back again, sort of thing. Other times it was a practice scramble, and we only got once did we get scrambled in earnest, and that was a Sunday, and we were fogged out. Yeva was in fog, and it was at Yeva on the North German plane, and we were scrambled. Now, you never got airborne in fog, and so we thought it was practice scramble, and so I was a junior pilot, and Pete Jennings was my leader in my pair, and we jumped into aeroplanes and we fired up and we checked in and with Broxedel, our radar station, and they said scramble, and we thought, don't believe it, you know, and off we went into the bloody fog and up on top, and in no time at all we had been given targets in every possible direction and height, and whenever we went to the nearest position for where the nearest target was, it vanished. We couldn't see it. There was nothing there physically in the sky. And we were then vectored onto another one. And behind us there was mayhem, because they were getting everybody out of the bar and out of their married quarters and everywhere else, and trying to get all the hunters airborne, because it looked as if World War III had happened. All sorts of people finished up scrambling behind us, and nobody ever found anything. We were as far east as I'd ever been. I mean, it was nothing but bloody collective farms and Christ knows what, and we had no idea what was happening, and we were running out of fuel, so we got diverted to one of the southern Germany stations. We couldn't have gone back to Yeva because of the fog. So the fleet was scattered all over Germany, and in the debrief, I suspect that it was some sort of, I think they call it anomalous propagation, whereby you can get blips on a radar screen in certain unusual MET circumstances. But I never really heard whether it was anomalous propagation or whether it was some Warsaw Pact ability to put blips up, you know, in the early sort of electronic type experimental days. I had no idea. But it was the only time I ever took the armament master switch off, and, you know, we thought we were going to do it for real. It didn't normally happen at all.